joining us today. This is Dr. Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. And you are listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we have this show on every Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m. Happy that you could join us. And what is so wonderful about all the Progressive Radio Network shows is that you can listen anytime on the archives at prn.fm and scroll down to Natural Nurse. And today we are very happy to have as our guest Dr. Moshe Dekel. Dr. Dekel is a board certified OBGYN in private practice for 35 years. In his many years in private practice, he served as the chief of GYN surgery at the Long Island Surgery Center and as the medical director of the Long Island Birthing Center. Dr. Dekel transitioned to holistic medicine well over a decade ago and is now taking care of the holistic needs of men, women, and children. He specializes in breast thermography, bioidentical hormone replacement, autism, ADD, and ADHD, emotional stress such as anxiety and insomnia, and overall nutrition. Dr. Dekel is also a DAN certified, which stands for Defeat Autism Now, practitioner, and works also with bioenergetic medicine. He has a practice on Long Island, New York, and Savannah, Georgia, as well as Hilton Head, South Carolina. So thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Dekel. Now, I know one of the things you're going to be doing is presenting at the Naval Expo, and we love to tell our listeners about the Naval Expo. They can find out more at navalexpo.com, and that's on many times a year, so just check your listings, and there's a date all the time coming up, so you want to check navalexpo.com. But Dr. Dekel, what will you be presenting about at the Naval Expo?
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about various topics. The main ones are going to be the environmental probiotics, but also I'm going to mention the importance of breast thermography in prevention of breast cancer, and also the role of getting our hormones in check to make sure that hormonally we are balanced, because it's so important for our quality of life. So these are the main issues we're going to talk about
Great. We'll talk about all of them because we have a whole hour for our show today, so it'll be definitely time to share all of those things. But I'd like to step back in history now, Dr. Dekel, to look at you as a person and what led you, one, to become a physician, two, to specialize in OBGYN in the first place.
That's a great question. And, you know, I don't want to be coy about it, but actually I have to thank my mother for telling me you can be a good doctor, a great doctor, not a good, a great doctor. But obviously, you know, making fun of this, you know, every Jewish mother wants their son and daughters to become a doctor. In my case, actually, I had 2 years of law back in Israel, University of Tel Aviv, which I hated. I just couldn't stand law. It was not me. And I am having graduated from biology in high school, et cetera, I was kind of led to this, and I said, you know what? This is something that I think I felt that I can do, and I wanted to help people, et cetera. And I actually had two friends of mine who went to Italy for medical school while I was in law school, and when they came on vacation summer, I asked them how they like medical school, and they said, we love it. I said, you know what? I'm going to go. And 6 years later, got my MD degree and came to the U.S., got my training here and started private practice as an OBGYN. But then back in 2000, I transitioned to holistic medicine. And you say, well, why? What made you change? And usually it's a personal story.
That was my next question. You're stealing my life, Dr.
I'm sorry. I'm taking your questions away. But,
right, so
you know,
before
asks,
we go
you know,
there, though.
And
I want to share that I have met many people whose babies you delivered. So even doing OBGYN, you certainly were helping tremendously, but I imagine you felt, as you learned more about natural medicine, you know, somewhat stifled in terms of expressing all this new knowledge that you have under the standards of practice required in conventional medicine?
Actually, you've given me too much credit. So let me explain to you how this happened.
Excellent.
Again, you're absolutely right. I delivered thousands of babies in my career, and I loved it. And in 2000, what happened is my back and neck, after 25 years of 80 hours a week of certain postures, just told me, hey, you're out. You can't do surgeries anymore. And I think I was lucky enough or maybe open enough to open the door to holistic medicine, which I like to call the real medicine. And I was astonished by how much information I was not taught, not in medical school, not in residency, internship, and 20 years of postgraduate studies. And I started to understand that this is not about just treating symptoms. This is about understanding the real understanding of physiology of the body and how it works and the biochemistry of the body and what we need to do in order to identify the real causes of what's causing our health to decline and what causes it to stay well. And I never looked back and continued to educate myself and being able to help my patients in a much more profound way and successful way for the last 15 years. So this is a journey that, for me, is just beginning.
You know, that's so true. And I love the way you mentioned that what might be called alternative medicine really is what we should be calling good evidence-based medicine. And little teeny drops of it are filtering through. For instance, us others who are even in the field that you were in, OBGYN, are now recognizing one nutrient, DHA, as actually being substantially linked to brain health for the babies if their mothers take it. Now, that would not even have been discussed a few years ago.
That is absolutely correct. And in my opinion, any woman who's contemplating pregnancy or pregnant definitely need to take omega-3 in high doses. And I'm talking about probably about 3 grams. Again, the doses are can be discussed back and forth, but it's a natural food. It actually proven to increase the IQ, baby's IQ, by 10 points, which is quite a substantial number. So you're absolutely right. It's very, very important.
Yeah, and so you would be telling people about that, but now that little teeny piece of information has snuck in to actually more conventional recognition, and yet it takes so long for these vastly proven evidence-based therapeutics to move into something that would be considered standard of practice. So seeing someone like yourself early on who's now, you know, sharing information about how you can balance hormones, environmental probiotics, natural, much less aggressive treatment and testing therapies such as thermography, it should really be standard of practice now, but it's not. So we need to go with two people like you who actually are on top of these concepts.
Well, the problem is that doctors are being taught in a certain way, which is the pharmaceutical way. I mean, what you do is you're being taught to diagnose and treat, and what kind of treatment you have. Well, it's either prescription drugs or surgery or anything related to it. In 35 years of medicine, or actually the first 20 years of 25 years of medicine, I did not have any schooling whatsoever about nutrition. Zero. None. Even today, my son finished medical school and I asked him, Alex, how much nutrition you had? He had 3 lectures on nutrition.
Well, congratulations about your son, though. That's wonderful that he's walking in your footsteps.
Thank you. So, you know that nutrition is 90% of our health. You know, we are what we eat. And yet, since it's not comes in a pill form, prescription form, the powers to be and still are in charge are not interested in educating doctors of prevention, because when we prevent, we actually taking less medication, which of course is not financially beneficial to certain segment of this industry. So what we need to do is really educate ourselves, go to practitioners who practice this type of medicine. And I'm not saying that once in a while you should not, and you have to take medication, but as you know, long-term medication doesn't help anybody. And unfortunately, the average 65-year-old American is taking 5 to 10 prescription drugs. And the majority of us have, what, side effects of these medications, and some of them pretty tough and detrimental to our health. So, yes, that's why, you know, you and I engage in consulting conversations and putting it out there in articles and interviews and TV, whatever the case may be, to open the door for everybody to look into it. Don't take it for granted. Just investigate, because this is something very important, evidence-based. Well, if it's evidence-based, it's evidence-based. It's not conjecture. It's not your opinion or my opinion or conventional medicine opinion. Let's look at the data. And more data is coming out to show that, hey, prevent number one, and number two, if there's a symptom, which means what? A messenger. Try to decipher the message. If you have pain anywhere, it's not a matter of taking painkillers. It's saying, okay, what is this pain telling us? What's causing it? What do we need? We need to go deeper and get to the base of it and fix the base so we don't hurt.
So true. You know, when you speak about this, Dr. Dekel, and I want to remind our listeners, you are listening to Dr. Moshe Dekel, board-certified OBGYN. Find out more at drdekel.com. That's drdekel.com, because this is a wise, experienced physician talking to you, not someone who manufactures supplements. This is the real truth. We are talking about the evidence. We are talking about the unfortunate case of science lagging, the practice of medicine lagging way behind the science of medicine. So Dr. Dekel has just moved forward and incorporated the highest level of knowledge into his current practice, where he specializes in such things as thermography, bioidentical hormone replacement, autism, and overall nutrition for everyone, men, women, and children, not only OBGYN medicine. So you have actually expanded your practice, Dr. Dekel.
Yes, I have. And it was kind of interesting because, you know, for 25 years I was taking care of just women. So it was a little strange, the first men to come to my practice. And how did men enter my practice? Because the women getting success, they said, can I bring my husband? I said, sure. Really, what's the difference between men and women? I mean, we have the same physiology. Well, we have different hormones. But other than that, you know, leaky gut is leaky gut, whether it be evident or present in men or women or children for that matter. So I got used to the idea of, you know, really why just limit the direct way of dealing with my patients just to women. I mean, men need help too. I mean, men's testosterone, for instance, goes down 1%, 1% to 2% per year from the age of 25 and on. So why not afford men natural bioidentical hormone replacement, where women have been taking it for quite a while? So after the initial kind of, can I do it? I said, of course I can do it. And again, I would say men are probably about 20-25% of my practice at this point, and children about 5%. Most of my patients are actually women because, as you know, women are the most proactive about their health, and they're the one who are actually moving the health industry forward as far as their knowledge and understanding and experience and telling their family, okay, this is the kind of medicine we're going to do. Am I right about that?
So true. So now let's look at a real specialty of yours, which I think is very unique, and that is thermography. Let's just start off by actually defining what is thermography.
Thermography is a modality that uses infrared camera to take images of the breast. That infrared camera actually takes about 75,000 bits of temperature on the breast, okay, per image, and convert it to colors that we can see as humans on a computer screen. We then analyze the differences temperatures between right and left. We also analyze the vascularity, the blood vessel supply to the breast, because we can see that as a temperature, because as the blood course through the breast, we actually, those areas are a little warmer, so we actually can, quote-unquote, see the blood vessels. And then we analyze the temperature differences, the way the architecture of the vascularity of the breast is, and then we are coming up with a risk analysis. In other words, is the image we're seeing is a normal image, or is it having low risk, moderate risk, or higher risk? At which point, I give to my patient a protocol to actually reduce that risk. So we never have to come down with a diagnosis. You know, now we have a clinical, actually, cancer. So cancer, as you know, is a preventable disease. The question is, what steps do we need to take in order to prevent it? And in my opinion, in opinion of a lot of patients who are now understanding that breast compression is not good for you and breast radiation is not good for you, and the fact that the adequacy or actually the percentage of accuracy of mammography on a good day is 65% only, and most women find that they have breast cancer about 6 months after they have a negative mammography, more women are open to the idea that, number one, they don't want to hurt them when they have the test, which is very painful. Number two, they realize that X-rays are not good for the breast. And they start to read and understand that every time we do a breast mammography, we're increasing our chance by 1% to 2% per study. They are open now to see, okay, what is mammography, what it can do for me. And in conjunction with ultrasound, we're actually getting a very good analysis of what's happening in the breast and what to do about it.
So that's amazing information, Dr. Deckel. What you're saying is that breast thermography can get you information about the possibility of developing breast cancer, which is why we do mammography, but breast thermography has no negative effects in doing the test, why mammography can actually cause a lot of problems. And, you know, I think that is why, and perhaps you can verify if this is true, even with mammography, I'm sure most women have heard, that there's big changes in terms of the recommendation of when to get it done. And I don't know why, but they say it's because there's no good relationship between how often people are getting it done and the decreased death from breast cancer. So why use all that radiation? I'm not sure exactly their reasoning, but they have changed the age parameters quite a bit in recent years.
Yes, they have. Not only that, but also the frequency. Now they're recommending every 2 years. You see, it's not a secret, because the studies have shown over the last 15, 20 years, that mammography, contrary to the propaganda, does not save lives, okay? And it's not early detection saves lives. They've shown it in multiple studies and big studies, the Canadian study and the Scandinavian studies, that followed 10,000 to 15,000 women over a 10-year period. And they actually showed, like what you said is true, that it actually has not increased the lifespan of women regarding breast cancer. So if that's the case, why subject women to a modality that actually increases the risk for breast cancer?
That's a good question.
Standard.
Why is
and equipment is there, and everybody's in a box, and nobody's willing to say, you know, the king has no clothes. And women now are in the forefront, like always, of saying, you know, maybe it's not good for me. And especially, you know, we have certain segment of population have what they call dense breast, which means what? You cannot see the anatomical structure of the breast because of density of the breast. The tissue is dense. So you can, even if you have mammography, you can't tell anything. So what they do, instead of saying, you know, and this is contraindicated for women who have dense breasts because mammography is not helpful. So what they say and what they do, instead of saying, you know, we really should do an ultrasound, we should do an MRI, or God forbid, thermography, because they don't know anything about thermography, they suggest that they do it twice a year now instead of once a year because maybe they can see something. So they continue to compress, they continue to do x-ray until, God forbid, they find something. But for women who have dense breasts, they really should not even consider mammography on any circumstances.
Right. Wow. What a difference. So you're saying it's even more dangerous for you if you have dense breasts. So instead of just having mammographies now twice a year or, you know, double the usual recommended amount, a better approach would be to use a technique such as thermography, which has no possible side effects. This is so huge. But what about who reads it? Because since thermography has not been embraced in standards of practice in terms of medicine, I would say there are people going around doing thermography who are not really trained like you are in terms of reading it.
Right. That's an excellent point. They do have thermography clinics that actually do the test, and then they send it over to board-certified doctors to read it. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that as long as, of course, these doctors are board-certified and know what they're doing. And they have these kind of clinics. So patient to understand, number one, who's doing it? Is the person who's doing it certified? Because we have to certify a technician, too. It has to be taken a certain way. It has to be done in a room of temperature between 67 and 73 degrees Fahrenheit. They have to do a cooling period. I'd like to do what we call the cold challenge test, which most board-certified doctors do, which is actually creating a fight or flight in a patient by letting her either hold ice back or put her hands for a minute in cold water, 65 degrees, 50 degree temperature for about a minute. So there are various technical points that need to be taken care of in order for us to get a decent, good study from which we can actually deduce clinical important items. So patients need to ask, well, what equipment do you use? You know, how adequate it is, how sensitive it is, who is doing it, and who is reading it. And once
what
they're
is,
satisfied
what is some of the best
to their
equipment,
level, then they can do
and
it.
And then recognize that you have something to recommend in terms of good equipment?
Well, there is now the company FLIR, F-L-I-R, is the largest manufacturer of thermal equipment in the world. And they have a medical arm, so to speak, and they've been manufacturing thermography equipment that is specifically designed for the human body. Because, as you know, they use thermal equipment for a variety of issues. I mean, even you have businesses that actually look at our houses to identify any mold because of cold areas in the room, et cetera. So this is different than what we use for the human body, because the cameras that I used for thermography are much more sensitive because, as I said, they have 75,000 bits of information in temperature that converts to the image, whereas, you know, industry does not have that kind of sophistication and sensitivity of that specific equipment. So, yes, it's important what equipment you use.
Hey, that's very big. I'm sure many people don't know that. Now, we have to take a little break right here, Dr. Deckel, and we're going to listen to the Natural Medicine Chest. When we come back, we are continue our discussion with Dr. Moshe Deckel, board-certified OBGYN. He will be presenting live. You can meet him either in Manhattan or on Long Island at the up-and-coming Naval Expo. Go to navalexpo.com to get the schedule, to get the dates, and to get a free magazine as well as free tickets. And so it doesn't even have to cost you anything to attend, and that's at navalexpo.com. And we will be right back with more after the Natural Medicine Chest right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss Sarsaparilla or Smilax officinalis.
Sarsaparilla is a tropical plant which grows in South America, Mexico, and Guatemala. Although most Americans are familiar with it as a flavor enhancer for root beer, it has also been used for its beneficial properties for hundreds of years by many different cultures. In Roman times, the young shoots were eaten, and the mature vines were worn as garlands at festivals of Bacchus. According to ancient Roman writings, sarsaparilla originated when the beautiful maiden, Smilax, was turned into a shrub after her love was slighted by the young crocus.
Sarsaparilla was brought to Europe in the 16th century by Spanish traders. A French physician, Nicolas Monardus, published a comprehensive account of sarsaparilla as a treatment for syphilis in 1574. During Portuguese military operations in 1812, a British inspector general of hospitals noted its positive effect on syphilis patients. It has also been used in China for treatment of the same condition. Sarsaparilla was included in the United States Pharmacopeia until 1950 as a recommended treatment of secondary syphilis.
Sarsaparilla's medicinal action appears to be a result of binding bacterial endotoxins in the gut, thereby decreasing their absorption. This greatly reduces the stress on the liver and is likely responsible for its historic use as a tonic and blood purifier.
In a controlled study of 92 patients published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1942, a chemically active component of sarsaparilla, called sarsaponin, greatly improved psoriasis in 62% of the patients and resulted in complete clearance in 18%. Sarsaparilla is often recommended by naturopathic physicians for gout, arthritis, and psoriasis. Another folkloric use for sarsaparilla is as a tonic for male sexual potency.
So, if you want a root beer flavored tea with a long history as a healthy tonic, reach for the sarsaparilla in your natural medicine chest.
Back to more right here on Natural Alternatives. Thank you for joining us, and we love to meet with you in person. How do you do that? You go to naturalnurse.com and look at the calendar of events. We're having a Chinatown herb walk coming up right away in Chinatown. We have that twice a year. You can join us and go to the Chinese Museum, do Qigong in the park, experience herbal medicine, the old-fashioned traditional medical way, learn about tongue and pulse diagnosis, learn about patent medicines and how to use them for yourself and your family. And we also have many classes where we go outside and actually identify edible and medicinal wild plants all over the area and make them into medicine that you take home. In addition, we have a plethora of online classes in holistic medicine, in herbal medicine, nutrition, homeopathy, and our online classes are actually CE Broker certified, which means if you are a healthcare provider, you can get your CE credits by taking our online classes. And that includes nurses, midwives, acupuncturists, dietitians, massage therapists, and other health professionals. If you're not a health professional, then you can get a certificate for taking a number of our online classes. So all kinds of interactive concepts are available. We also have a class, I think it's coming up next week, on spirituality. So we would love to hear from you. Go to naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse. And either of those places, you can actually find a way to get in touch with us very easily, naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse. And again, we love to hear from you. And we love to have our guest on today and tell you more about him, and that is Dr. Moshe Dekel. Dr. Deckel is a board-certified OBGYN in private practice for 35 years. We have been talking to him about integrative practices, and I love the word integrative because Dr. Deckel is certainly highly qualified in conventional medicine, but has also brought in what I like to call traditional medicine, which is natural medicine, as well as the best medicine, which is evidence-based, based on the science. So we are talking about thermography and other naturally based therapies that Dr. Deckel integrates into his medical practice. He's available on Long Island, Savannah, Georgia, Hilton Head, South Carolina, and also will be one of the presenters, along with myself and about 100 other holistic practitioners, at the Naval Expo. That's Naval, NAVELEXPO.com, where you can get free tickets, free magazine, free schedule, and join us in Manhattan and the Huntington Hilton on Long Island twice a year. There are two of them coming up very, very shortly after this broadcast, whenever you listen to it. So thank you so much for joining us again, Dr. Deckel.
Great to be with you. And very stimulating conversation. Love it.
Now, you were explaining to us why it seems like thermography would be a much better first intervention, in my opinion, and I believe your opinion, then is mammography. It should be what is used on all women all the time, and the doctors should be highly trained in being able to read it appropriately. Why is that not happening?
That's an excellent question, and I really wish I had an answer for that. Thermography is not new. I mean, it's been around 50 years, started in Europe. Equipment in the beginning was kind of rudimental and cumbersome and not exact, but today's equipment really gives you a window into what may happen to the breast. In other words, the slogan of mammography is early detection saves lives. The real slogan should be early prevention saves lives. So what we can see as far as the breast physiology is concerned is what kind of risk we have. How does the breast look physiologically? And we can see changes. We have anatomical changes. So we have time to implement a protocol to actually prevent that anatomical structure, which is the lump, which is the cancerous tumor, from actually developing. Because before the tumor becomes even visible, okay, there are physiological changes in the area. The cells are replicating faster and therefore creating higher temperature. There's more blood supply to the area and therefore higher temperature, which can be detected by the thermography. So in thermography, we can actually see who is at higher risk and what we can do to reduce the risk by following them on short intervals to see that what we're doing is actually working before ultrasound or mammogram or MRI can pick up any structural changes. So in my opinion, it's the ultimate way to prevent the disease, and also relying on ultrasounds that have no radiation, no compression, to look at the anatomy of the breast. So really, I want to repeat this. It's important to understand. Thermography looks at physiology of the breast. It gives us a window into the future. Ultrasound looks at the anatomy of the breast, what currently is in the breast. And even if I see, let's say, issues with the breast thermographically, okay, and I always recommend ultrasound also, rarely the ultrasound shows an issue, which means what? Good, we're in time. We can prevent this from becoming an issue by doing the protocol that need to be done, which is lifestyle and dietary and hormonal. It all depends what the story is. So we don't have to get this news, oh, we have a problem that we need to do biopsy or surgery or et cetera. So it's a no-brainer to us. But again, to change conventional medicine, I think we need to open doctors to the idea, to investigate, look at the science, look at the... This was approved by the FDA back in 1982. And we're talking 40 years ago, more. So it's not new. It's just a matter of it's not in the conscious of conventional doctors.
That's just amazing. What can be done to change that? I mean, it's always linked somehow to money, it seems.
Right. The only way to change it, in my opinion, is open the discussion and the educational process to women. Let them read the data. Let them go to a certain website, compare the data, listen to their gut. Listen, the majority of women are not looking forward to have a mammography exam. They know that the pain involved, and even if women say, you know what, it's not so bad, it's not, you know, I'm not painful with that. But innately, they know that radiation is not helping us. Okay, there's a reason why when you go to the dentist, the person gets out of the room, even though they say, hey, it's no big deal. Listen, any radiation is cumulative, and why get it if we don't need it? So,
especially
I hate
since
to
radiation
say, but I gave up on educating doctors.
Problem.
Yeah, I gave up on educating doctors. My job, as I see it, is educating my patients and let them get to a point where they can make an intelligence decision based on knowledge, not on fear. And that's it. I mean, and if they decide they still want mammography, God bless them. That's okay. I mean, it's their right to do that.
Right. You're not trying to take that away as a choice. You're just trying to educate people that perhaps there's a better choice. And I do want to say on your website, which is drdekel.com, you actually have a lot of wonderful education resources where people can find more. You even have a YouTube link where you do a lecture on breast mammography that, you know, presents a lot of the facts.
That is correct. And again, when you ask me what can we do about it, I have three words: education, education, education. It's there.
So people can
the only thing they have to do is just go and look at it and be skeptical about it. Ask the questions. Don't take it as gospel. You know, educate yourself to the point you say, you know what, this seems to me right, or no, I don't think it's good for me. We want to empower our patients to take their decision-making back into their hands and make medical decisions like we make anything else in our life. When we go shopping, we decide what to do, what to shop for. Well, when we shop for medical knowledge and medical practices, we need to understand what are we looking for. What kind of doctor we should go to see that actually looks at medicine the way we look at it and how we feel about it, instead of getting to dictate to us because they know better and we're just, you know, there to fulfill their data. So it's important for people to start taking responsibility to make their own decisions about medicine by educating themselves.
Now, what about sonograms? Because you certainly can also get breast sonograms. I mean, what I do personally, I'll share with my listening audience here, I personally have never had a mammography. My mom, who's 87, had a mammography once, okay, and she felt it was an absolutely horrible experience. And also, I have to say, thank God, genetically, I have no cancer risk anywhere in my family. You know, so that's something you may want to take. And it's not like everybody in my family had breast cancer. No one did, ever, that I know of. So taking that into consideration, taking into the fact of whatever in terms of my own general health, you know, my mother's history, my aunt's history. So I decided also never to have a mammography. I have never had a mammography, but I have had thermographies. I went to Dr. Dekel to have a thermography. I also have had sonograms. So what kind of information between those two could we gather versus what we gather from a mammography?
Okay, excellent question. So as we said before, mammography is an anatomical test. Thermography is physiological. Ultrasound is also anatomical, and MRI is also anatomical. What do I mean by that? We're looking with ultrasound and MRI, we're looking at structural changes in the breast. In other words, are we having a cyst? Are we having a mass? Are we having a shadow? And we'll look at what is normal and what is abnormal. So you say, well, what's the difference between mammography and ultrasound? Well, ultrasound today is so sophisticated that, in my humble opinion, it actually see much better than mammography. So you say, well, why don't they do it at all? Well, there's one item that ultrasound doesn't see, and that is calcification, okay? Mammography sees calcification because the calcified areas actually light up because of the X-ray modality, okay, whereas ultrasound does not. The issue is that a large majority of calcifications don't mean anything, but they create a stress in the radiologist looking at the X-ray, and therefore stress at the patient, because nobody wants to miss anything, okay? And clearly, medicine today is practiced defensively, considering the malpractice crisis we've had for a long time. So when they see almost any kind of calcification, they say, you know what, I think it's normal, but, and the big word here is the but. And patient hear nothing but the but, and you say, but, if you want to make sure, I think I would like to get some biopsy here just to make sure. I don't think it's anything but. And therefore, we are performing 1.6 million biopsies a year in the United States. 80% of them are negative, which means that 80% of them should not have been performed to begin with. So we are over-treating, over-diagnosing, and over-biopsying everybody.
Well, I know so many women who have had biopsies, and it's been a terrible experience for them. And they have had, you know, complications from the biopsy, as well as pain. And thank God, in these particular situations, they were negative. So there are times when someone has a biopsy and they do find out about a very early stage cancer, and then it was worth going through the biopsy.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That is correct. But again, what I would like to note is that, if we have enough reason to do a biopsy, I think that women should actually discuss the possibility of excisional biopsy versus a needle biopsy. The difference is, with a needle biopsy, obviously you go in and, you know, it's a core biopsy or fine needle aspiration, and you actually take some material from the area that is suspicious, and you put it on the microscope to diagnose it. Whereas excisional biopsy is a modality by which we make a small incision and we take the area out that is involved, whether it be a pea size or more or less, and now we have the entire area out for diagnosis and treatment the same way. In my opinion and my investigation, it seems that if we are puncturing an area of cancer with a needle, I don't think we have to be rocket scientists to see that the possibility of spreading the disease is there. So this is something that women need to be aware of before they say yes or no. So they need to investigate it. And what I find is that they're put in such state of fear and urgency, state of urgency. It's like, you have to do it now. Listen, whatever is happening in the breast, it took years. So waiting a week to actually ask the questions, read the information, and make a decision which direction to go is really putting anybody at risk. So again, what we need to tell women is, educate yourself about what is there, what kind of direction you can go, so you can make the right decision, not say, you know, I should have done something else. And that's, I hear this a lot in my practice. Had I known, I would have done something else. And that's, I believe, we should help women to make the right decision.
Well, you certainly are by sharing your information, and we're going to go to another break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is a station ID in which you'll get to hear some promotions about other fantastic shows that are right here on Progressive Radio Network. And what's so wonderful is you can catch them live, just like you can catch The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time every Tuesday. Or you can visit our show or any of the Progressive Radio shows right here at PRN.FM on the archives. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. us, naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse. Get in touch and we will get back to you. We will send you our schedule, or you can just go to naturalnurse.com and click on calendar, and you'll see some of the events that are coming up, such as a Chinatown trip, herbal identification workshops in the field, the Naval Expo at navalexpo.com, where I will be presenting at 10 a.m. on genetically modified information. What does that mean? What do GMOs mean to you? And Dr. Deckel, our guest today, Dr. Moshe Deckel, who you can find at drdeckel.com, that's D-R-D-E-K-E-L.com, will also be at the Naval Expo talking about all these fascinating topics that he's sharing with us on today's show. And so thank you so much for all that information about thermography, Dr. Deckel. I think it's actually brave of you to stand up for thermography, seeing as sometimes the establishment doesn't particularly really support physicians who leave the fold of standard of practice and walk their own path, which is really based on evidence. So thank you for being a forerunner in that field. And well, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the other fabulous work that you're involved in. What are you doing in terms of DAN, Defeat Autism Now?
Good question. We find that the majority of autistic kids had a genetic predisposition for autism, but it looks like it was triggered usually by vaccination. And I know that the courts have decided it has nothing to do with it, but you and I, who are, you know, clinical practice, we cannot ignore the multitude of patients, families telling us that everything was fine until the vaccination. And I cannot believe and refuse to believe that families are actually inventing these stories. I mean, they're devastating by, you know, 2-year-old getting all of a sudden all the autistic spectrum signs after immunization. And it's again and again and again. So I personally, with the information that I read and follow very carefully with other doctors like Dr. Tenpenny and others who are very advanced in that field, that it probably triggers the autism spectrum. So what we need to do is we, number one, need to change lifestyle. A lot of young children do not have the right diet. It's mainly carbs, it's mainly processed, it's a lot of sugar. So we absolutely need to change the diet to get them off wheat, which is very allergenic, off dairy, which is also very allergenic and causes brain disorders, and mainly sugar. As you know, sugar is really, quote-unquote, toxic to the brain. So we find that initial steps are definitely improving them drastically. Also, we need to treat the gut. Okay, the gut is called the second brain. In many instances, you and I like to call it the first brain, because without the gut, we don't have brain at all. So leaky gut and the other adjunct items that are connected with that needs to be fixed. And these are the basic that we start to help families with dealing with autism. It can be helped. It really can. We see a lot of improvement just by changing diets and starting to take care of the gut. A lot of these young children have either constipation or diarrhea or combination thereof, and this is telling us that, you know, treat the gut, treat the gut. But definitely,
the thing is that, of course, a wonderful thing to do, if you're going to be working with children, really the family has to get involved. You can't, you know, hide the bread just from that child and everybody else is eating Twinkies.
Right. And it's not easy. It's not easy because we're so, you know, it's much easier to get ready-made food, microwave it, and do chicken fingers or, you know, and just feed the kids just out of the box. Yes, I know that the majority of families, both parents work and time is limited, But that is not going to work for the autistic or sensitive child. I mean, not even with autism. I mean, how many children nowadays have issues with their skin? Eczema and psoriasis and learning disabilities. No matter where you look, it starts with one thing. What are they putting in their mouth? So you're right. It's definitely a family affair, and it's a family decision to make that determination. The thing is, with autism, we have no choice because it's so severe. But what about these children that have repeated ear infections? I mean, it's diet. It's diet and inflammation. It's not about putting on antibiotics every 2 months because, if anything, it actually destroys the gut environment and sets them out for a life of chronic diseases. So I definitely agree with you. It's a family affair.
Very much so. But what a difference it makes. Isn't it wonderful? I mean, part of what you're doing now is dietary intervention, nutrition, looking at ADHD, which is unfortunately so prevalent in children. And, you know, it's interesting that I think there's a link, if we look at the data, between the massive amount. I mean, it's one thing to do vaccinations, but you, I'm sure, as an OBGYN, have seen many of these hospitals actually give a brand new baby, not just one or two, but a whole series of vaccinations right when they're born.
Yes. In fact, one of my concerns is that a newborn gets a hepatitis B vaccine, which is really a sexually transmitted disease. So the question I have is, what is the possibility of a newborn being exposed to sexually transmitted disease in the nursery? And, I mean, it's one thing if the mother has a history of hepatitis B. I mean, but very few do. And the majority of parents don't even know that when they sign a consent to get admitted, that it's written in there. So unless they say, we are not willing to allow our babies to get any immunization in the nursery, their baby's going to get it. Okay, so here we have a newborn just getting out of a perfect protected environment in mother's womb, protected by her immune system, getting into the world, starting to assimilate the probiotics that they've accumulated during the birth process. And now we are actually bombarding their immune system with something that nature did not intend to do. And the question is, why? And more people need to question it and decide if they want their babies to be having a hepatitis B vaccine upon birth. So the problem is that a lot of patients don't even know that it's being done. So our conversation brings it to light. And again, I recommend to all prospective parents to really do research. One of the best sites I know of is, again, Dr. Tenpenny. She has a very impressive site and data. I mean, it's only one site that I know of, but there's quite a few of them. Get the information, educate yourself about it so you can make a decision about your children. We still are lucky that in New York we have religious exemption, but what about these patients who live in California? To my understanding, they...
Well, how about New Jersey?
Oh, they do.
Who's rapidly making that, you know, not something you can use.
Wow. Well, you know, we as society need to decide how far we should allow the government to dictate to us what to put in our bodies.
Well, this
because
is so
really,
true. We're going to end on that note, but I want to thank you so much for all of your excellent and educated input to teach people about different modalities that may open a world of possibilities, safer, healthier possibilities for them, such as using and considering thermography before you run for your mammography. So thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Dekel.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you for your great work of educating people. Good luck.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Get in touch at naturalnurse.com. Come see us at navalexpo.com. And until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.